You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest tonight is renowned historian Joyce Lee Malcolm. She's a professor at the Anton Scalia Law School of George Mason University. She's the author of Guns and Violence, Pete's War, and To Keep and Bear Arms. And her latest book is a fascinating history called The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold, An American Life. Joyce Lee Malcolm, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I think most Americans today know almost nothing about the entire Revolutionary War era.
Yeah, I think that's sadly true, and probably even less about Arnold, other than, you know, that his name is a synonym for traitor.
And I guess for good reason. I mean, was he, in fact, a traitor?
Well, he did change sides and, prepare to surrender West Point to Washington. Prepared to surrender West Point to the British. Yes, to that extent. But he was also one of the greatest heroes of the Revolution, and we probably never would have won it without him.
Well, and your book details all that so interestingly. I mean, it's really a war story more than anything else. But I was also fascinated just by the world of the Revolution, the picture that you painted, beginning with Benedict Arnold's boyhood, and not just him in particular, but not only a strict upbringing, but just a strict world where young people weren't allowed to laugh or...
Yes, that was early Connecticut, and it was a small community that he lived in Norwich, and any embarrassment, you know, everyone would know about. People who drank too much had their names listed on the door of the tavern as tavern frequenters. The church took a very strict eye and attitude toward people, or especially young people, who were too jolly on the Sabbath. So it was a very rigid kind of society.
I find that part so fascinating because, of course, today there's nothing, I mean, there's very little like that, including the fact that people, I don't know, I don't think that the people value their name the way they once did. And, of course, that's a whole big part of this Benedict Arnold story.
Yes, there was a tremendous emphasis put on personal honor and reputation, particularly among men, although for women, too, of course. And when you think about it, that was one of the reasons that they had so many duels when... Hamilton was killed by Burr in a duel. That was Hamilton's 11th duel. So in order to protect one's honor, there was this need to actually have to come to blows, or at least be willing to risk one's life to protect one's honor.
And Benedict Arnold had a few duels as well.
Oh, yes, he did. He did, even near the end of his life. He was extraordinarily brave about that, and you get the sense that he almost wished that he would have been killed in one of these laid on because his life had become so disappointing.
Now, let me, Dr. Malcolm, see if you can just tell us more about the idea of a duel. I mean, if people are fighting a duel, does that mean that somebody's going to die, or does it, I mean, are those guns not so great and then you could just shoot and not hit
a gun? Yeah, there seem to be different rules of how it was to work. And sometimes one person who had insulted the other might apologize rather than being shot at. Sometimes someone was just wounded. There was usually someone there in case there was a wound. The governments were beginning to clamp down on this because obviously it went around the rule of law. But there were seconds there, and it was still not frowned upon by gentlemen. But there was just this really intense desire to protect one's personal integrity and honor.
So tell us a little bit then about Benedict Arnold's young life, pre-war life.
Yes, his father was a very successful merchant, seaman, and sailed his own ships up and down the coast of from Canada to the Caribbean and occasionally across to England. And So Arnold, as a young boy, had a very happy life, and his dad would take him summertime sailing with him. He had sisters, but he was the only boy in the family. And then the intention was by his parents that they would send him to college, and he was sent off to a boarding school in preparation for that. And while he was away, two of his little sisters died, I think probably of yellow fever. There were all these epidemics that sort of swept the people at that time. And his father became very depressed and drank a lot, and his shipping business went downhill, and he became a debtor. And so he was really a public disgrace. He was, you know, both a public drunk and a debtor, and a committee from the church came and tried to get him to straighten up. So the family was really devastated, and Arnold was pulled out of school. And instead of going to college, he ended up serving an apprenticeship, which actually turned out okay. His mother had some relatives who were pharmacists and had a shop in Norwich, and they trained Arnold in pharmacy, and they had the only pharmacist shop between, I think, New York and Pennsylvania, so they were very successful, and he worked really hard and got his own business and sailed his own ships and was able to kind of pay off the family mortgage and debts. But it was very difficult, and he never seemed to say anything I have ever seen against his father, but it must have been extraordinarily difficult to live in a small town with that kind of public family disgrace.
And, you know, nowadays, of course, I happen to be a debtor. I'm sure you, everybody's a debtor.
Yeah, we don't have the same sense of it. Well, I'll tell you, one of my colleagues is an expert in bankruptcy, and they didn't really have the bankruptcy laws. They were just coming in. So debtors went to prison, and they were put into prison with ordinary criminals. So the bankruptcy laws were really a great benefit in allowing you to pay off your debt instead of being in prison until you could somehow pay it off. Yeah, all of us are, but we do try and keep our heads above water.
Well, that reminds me that in your book, people are often being whipped and beaten and put in stocks and such things.
Yeah, there was a lot of public shaming, and I think that goes along with this idea of embarrassment and trying to keep one's reputation so that, you know, public embarrassment. I mean, in a sense, when you think some of the social media these days, we may be getting
it's
back to that.
Early version of YouTube was putting somebody's name on a sign, right?
Yes. Somebody's name on the tavern where all the neighbors could see it and gossip about it.
Continue and tell us how you know, what happened next with Arnold. He was an apprentice.
He was an apprentice. His uncles who had trained him gave him some money to start his own business. He moved to New Haven, which was a very burgeoning town, and that's where, of course, the college that was to be Yale was. And so he ended up, you know, buying books in Britain and bringing them back, selling them to the students and all kinds of other things, horses and whatever would make money.
Being a horse trader was a bad thing?
Well, it's funny because reading about it now, I mean, it sounds like a good thing. I've had a horse, but apparently in those days it was sort of it had the same aura as being a used car salesman. There was this sense that you couldn't really trust people who sold horses. You know, this idea of looking a gift horse in the mouth, it's kind of suspicion about it. But he really was sort of out for the main chance. He really looked at opportunities. So he would, you know, buy things in the Caribbean and sell them in New England or go up to Canada and get things. So he was very enterprising, and he went personally on a lot of these voyages. But when he got married to a young woman who was from an eminent family in New Haven, she was quite annoyed at all the time that he was spending sailing his own vessels. And he did quite well. Once the Battle of Lexington and Concord happened, he had been training a local militia and was eager to sort of get involved. And after he spent all this time in the war, which he ended up doing, his business was sort of left in the hands of his sister. And women of in that time who were in the same family or are married to merchant seamen often did do a lot of the sort of the paperwork and looking after the business. But obviously at that point, you know, his business went downhill and the British were out seizing American trading vessels. So while he started off being extremely successful, it was really a problem and a sacrifice, dedicating himself to being in the service.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Joyce Lee Malcolm. She's the author of The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold, An American Life. Benedict Arnold wrote quite a few letters. He was a very good writer.
Yes, he was. And unfortunately, she didn't write back, it seemed really sad
cruel.
And puzzling. Yes, cruel even. And I don't know why, whether she was just a very aloof person. She only wrote him a couple of times when she wanted him to help her father out, who was having difficulty financially. So you feel very sorry for him, and I don't know whether his love was totally reciprocated the way she behaved, one has to wonder. But she did pass away. She died while he was away with the military in 1776, so that was very sad. But he did have a kind of a rocky time with that relationship, and it wasn't his fault. And he ended up with three young sons, and when his wife died, his sister took over raising those three boys.
Well, I want to know more about them and what became of them once their father became branded, I guess you'd say. But before we get to that, tell me how he got involved in the war, how his place in and his friendship with George Washington and so on.
Yeah, he was an extraordinary military officer. He had never really had any experience until shortly before the war, when tensions rose with the British. He became the captain of a small Minuteman group in New Haven. And once fighting broke out, he led his men to Cambridge, where they were all amassed, having completed the bar. He missed the fight at Lexington and Concord, but after that, all of these militia groups kind of converged on Cambridge, and George Washington came from the Continental Congress and took over command of what he said was a terrible group. He praised the leaders in Massachusetts for how wonderful it was, but privately he said he'd never seen such a nasty bunch of officers. They weren't clean. The men were going everywhere. People were coming and going. And Arnold had the idea of going to Ticonderoga, where there were cannon, and seizing these cannon and bringing them back, which would help them to be able to threaten the British in Boston and get them to leave. And so he went off to do that. He was commissioned by Massachusetts to do that. He did meet Washington, and Washington was very struck by what an enterprising fellow this was. And Washington was also, I think, extraordinarily good in being willing to promote and use men of merit. He wasn't a snob when it came to that. I think he really appreciated it. And I should add that because Arnold was a merchant, he would be looked down on by people like John Adams. John Adams had gone to Harvard, and he felt that Washington was an illiterate because Washington had never gone to college. So we like to think that there was not this class prejudice, but there was. After Ticonderoga, there was the desire of Washington and others to try to get Canada to come over to the patriotic side. But we always had this sort of love-hate relationship with Canada. We invite them to come along, and then if they don't, we're ready to attack them. And that is what happened. And Arnold had the idea of taking a group of men directly through the wilderness of Maine to Quebec City. And another group under the command of General Montgomery was to take a more traditional route through New York State the two armies were to meet. But no one had much of an idea of what was going to happen in Maine or what lay between the Kennebec River and the Canadian border. And there had just been a couple of explorers who had gone through there. And Arnold and his men had all these boats, and it ended up with miles and miles of having to carry these heavy boats around rapids and ravines. And it took them over 3 weeks, and in the end, they ran out of food. Some of the men were living on their shoe leather. There's one man who wrote a diary of what happened, and he ended up eating a squirrel's head. I mean, we don't want to get into it for your audience, but they had a terrible time. But Arnold was wonderful in keeping them together, keeping it going, keeping their spirits up. And they did end up getting through to Canada and to Quebec. But unfortunately there, when they met up with Montgomery's army, they ended up attacking in the winter. And part of that was that the Continental Congress was not ready to have a standing professional army, so they relied on men having short enlistments. And a lot of the men who were there in Canada were going to have their enlistments up soon, so they really needed to use them before that happened. And they unfortunately attacked Quebec, which was difficult anyway because it's on a cliff, overlooking the St. Lawrence. And the day that they had chosen, there was a terrible snowstorm. And in the middle of this snowstorm, they attacked. And Montgomery, who was the leader of the expedition, was killed instantly. And Arnold, leading another group on the assault, was wounded and taken to a field hospital. So it was a failure, and they ended up spending the winter besieging this city. And one of the items I loved, a little story about Arnold at that point. He's wounded. He's in the field hospital with other wounded people. And there's a fear that the British and Canadians are going to invade the field hospital. And Arnold orders that all of the wounded there be given guns so that at the end they can at least defend themselves and put up a good fight. And I just sort of love the picture of all these injured men being handed, rifles and pistols in order to protect themselves. But that's just the way he was. He had a whole series of really amazing exploits, military exploits, both on land and sea. And I think it makes for, a really exciting story. I could go into others, but I'm not sure how much.
I love hearing about it. That's the thing about this book. It's a war story, or lots of war stories, which kind of surprised me. I mean, I don't know why I was surprised, but, you think of the Revolutionary War, the weaponry was kind of primitive by our standards, and the kind of crazy notion we have of them just lined up and marching toward each other and and shooting one bullet at a time.
Yes, yes, and taking time to reload while you were very vulnerable. Now it was really difficult. There were cannons, but they weren't all that reliable either. My favorite adventure that he had was in 1776. The British, Canada not having been conquered, planned to come down the Lake Champlain and take Albany. They really very much wanted to separate New York State off from New England. And this would enable them to take Albany and meet up with the Hudson River, and that would succeed in doing that. And so actually what they did was that they not only sent men, but they also sent ships. And the ships that they sent to Canada, they were disassembled and reassembled in Canada, which I thought was quite amazing for that time period. They just sent, kind of prefabricated sailing vessels. But at any rate, they were planning to come down, and the Americans learned about it, but had no way of stopping that. And so Arnold, having all of this experience as a sailor and having sailed his own ships, was asked if he would build a fleet on the shore there in order to keep the British from fleet from coming all the way to Albany, or at least hold them back as long as he could. He had 3 months in which to build a fleet of little ships in the middle of the New York State, and he personally chose thousands of boards for it. He got all of these carpenters. He got people, as many as he could. Washington was fighting elsewhere and had a lot of the coastal sailors and people who really had more experience than the ones that Arnold was able to get. But within those 3 months, Arnold was able to get together a little fleet of about 15 of these sailing ships and some smaller ones. And he patrolled Lake Champlain to see where the best place would be to be able to tackle this British fleet, which was going to be a far more, you know, powerful, big warships with lots of cannon. And he decided to hide his fleet around an island called Valcour Island, which was near the western shore on the New York side of Lake Champlain as opposed to the Vermont side. And Valcour Island had this little channel. It was quite near the shore. And he hid his fleet in that little channel. And the British fleet came down the main channel of the lake and didn't see Arnold's fleet until they got maybe 5 miles beyond Valcour Island. And then they spotted them. And, of course, then they had to turn around and fight at a disadvantage with these sailing vessels. And there was a tremendous battle. And at the end of a long day of fighting and the cannons wrecking Arnold's little fleet, Arnold had his fleet retreat back into this channel. And that night, he had the problem with being in that channel was that their line of retreat was cut off by the British Navy, who were at the southern end of the channel. But his plan was that they would somehow sneak by the British fleet. And fortunately, the British fleet was about a mile or so into the water. And so he got his little ships together, the ones that were still sailable, and they went quietly past that British fleet to go south of them. They put all the wounded sailors in below deck so that any moaning would not be heard, so they could go by very quietly. They put shirts wrapped around the oars so that they wouldn't make any noise. And they slipped by the whole of that British fleet. And the next morning, when the British felt that they were going to finish off this American fleet, they discovered that they were gone. And they assumed that they had gone north up that channel, but it was very shallow. They could not have done it, but the British didn't know that. So they went up north looking for them. And in the meantime, the American fleet was going lickety-split, or as far as it could, south back toward the forts and toward Albany. And then the British, of course, realized their mistake and pursued them. And near the end, Arnold's ship and one other one, according to his orders, turned to face the British fleet while allowing the rest of his ships to get away. And they had a tremendous battle, and these other ships of Arnold's, you know, surrendered because it was so badly hurt. Arnold then, as commander of his little ship, fought on until he could do it no more. And then he took that vessel into a little creek. All his men got off. They burnt the ship, and then they went overland for 20 miles carrying their wounded in sails to get away. They went to Crown Point, and then they had to go back toward the Ticonderoga. So it was he lost in the sense that the British still had command of Lake Champlain, but it was getting late in the season, and the British commander Carleton decided that he didn't want to have his fleet frozen in this wilderness area of upstate New York, and so the British actually retreated back to Canada, saving Albany and saving New York State for the year. So it was just a tremendous effort. He was just extraordinarily able, and not only personally brave, but able to get men to follow him in very dangerous circumstances. So it's, you know, it was a long book to write because he had done so many exciting things.
And I guess that also sent a message to the British that it wasn't going to be a pushover to just come and take the colonies. And...
No, but what was annoying, and to me anyway, and I'm sure it was to Arnold reading it, was that people blamed him for not winning. I mean, they claimed that he had been reckless, that, you know, men had been killed, it didn't need to be. But he had followed orders, and there was no way he could have defeated that powerful fleet. But he did the best that he could, and he held them, you know, back and until they decided that it didn't pay to pursue their conquest any further that year.
So another one of the many times that Benedict Arnold was misunderstood, misinterpreted.
He had a lot of enemies. I think he didn't suffer fools gladly, and so if people were cowardly, he was kind of rough with them. He had great friends, but he had enemies, and sometimes there were people who were simply jealous of him or felt guilty. On his march through the wilderness of Maine, there was one leader, an officer of a regiment, who decided that he could take it no longer and that he and his men turned back without orders and was arrested by Washington when he got back. But people like that resented Arnold because he had been brave, and it made them look bad, I think.
Interesting. And so tell me, when Arnold... I have two questions about the role that finances played in...
Yes.
In both Arnold's life and also just in the revolution itself. To what degree, I mean, I know that we bathe the Revolutionary War and the idea of liberty and all that, but how much did finances play in our desire to become an independent country? And how much did it play in Arnold's decision to switch sides?
Well, finances were really important, and Sadly, the Continental Congress was never able to fully fund their army. I mean, the soldiers weren't paid for months. They printed currency that was almost worthless, so that, you know, an officer would get at the end of months, you know, enough money to maybe buy a pair of boots. The army wasn't properly equipped, and of course there are all these really true stories about the suffering of that army at Valley Forge and other places. They were in rags. They weren't properly fed. And part of that was not just that the Continental Congress couldn't get together the money. It was that there were merchants who wouldn't sell to them. Washington was very scathing about the merchants in Philadelphia, which was then the capital, really our biggest city, because the money that was being printed by the Patriot side wasn't worth much. They preferred to sell to the British. So there was all of this issue about people not wanting to take the risk of selling to the Continental Congress. And at the same time, people like Arnold, who were in the shipping business, were suffering because the British had this practice of sort of seizing prize ships and trying to keep the American merchant fleet from being able to trade and capturing their ships, so that the trading community really suffered very badly. And despite all of that, Arnold tended to, when necessary, pay his own men from his own money. But what happened was that in events like his going through Maine and having this long siege of Quebec, the powers that be in the Continental Congress blamed him for not keeping better accounts. He was wounded, and he actually asked them for a paymaster, someone who would take care of the financial end of things, and they never sent anybody. And they were forever afterwards, when he got back, claiming that he had wasted the money that they had sent him for this campaign. And right up to the end, when he was debating whether to leave or not to switch sides, Congress had a special investigation of his finances and claimed that he owed them £1,000. And this is a man who had risked his life time after time. He had been grievously wounded and crippled in the cause.
Hadn't spent his own money.
And they hadn't paid him. And yet they are having an investigation that he owes them money. I thought that was just, I don't know, I'm gasping here, but it was so unfair that was all that they could see. You know, when they were so bad about trying to pay their own people and keep up with their own obligations.
This is KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. The show is From the Bookshelf, and my guest is Joyce Lee Malcolm. She's the author of The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold, An American Life. In your book, Benedict Arnold felt that the Continental Congress was continuing the Revolutionary War even after the British had acceded to all their original demands. Is that right?
Yes, late on. I think once the English realized that we were negotiating with the French, and the French, of course, were doing it to sort of get back at the English for the French and Indian War that they had lost, so they were trying to make trouble for the English. But the English decided that they would try to give us what we had asked, really. So there, in 1778, they sent over a group called the Carlisle Commission, and that commission was authorized to promise and give the Americans all of the things that they had complained about, you know, representation in Parliament, you know, no taxes that we hadn't approved, and so forth. The only thing that they weren't allowed to promise was independence. And so that there were Americans, as well as Arnold, who felt that that was not a bad idea, that, you know, accepting that because there was no way they were sure they were actually going to win independence, and this way they would have spared a lot of people's bloodshed, end the war, and get what the original objectives were, because originally Americans hadn't been looking for independence. We sometimes forget that it was an entire year between Lexington and Concord in April 1775 and July 1776 when Congress finally votes for independence. So this would have, you know, been a victory for what the original objectives were. And there were some people that were, you know, who felt that that probably would have been a good thing to accept. It's just that there had been all these years of warfare and loss of life and violence, and so that agreement wasn't, and those conditions were no longer acceptable. They really did want independence.
Almost like the Vietnam War, when it was impossible to just pull out because so many people had already died.
Yes. I mean, there's so much commitment, you know, atrocities, houses burnt, you know, people killed, all kinds of suffering, that, you know, your original objectives tend to get kind of lost and a more radical view takes part. And so if the British had promised independence, the war would have ended. But we weren't about to negotiate, and Congress never negotiated. It didn't even meet with the Carlisle Commission. So that was, you know, sort of unfortunate. Although they do say, and I haven't really studied it carefully myself, but it seems that way, that in the actual negotiations at the end of the war, that the British tried not to be too harsh on us because they were afraid that then we would be dependent on France or Spain. So they didn't want to really ruin us.
They still wanted to sell us stuff and things like
yes,
that.
Yes, they did. They wanted our goods and they wanted to sell us. So there's your financial incentive as well.
Yeah. Well, so after Arnold switched sides, and he switched sides even though his traitorous plan didn't actually come to pass, but so he wasn't executed? What happened?
He escaped. He had a secret meeting with a man named John Andre, who was in charge of intelligence and spying for the British, and who was operating in New York City under General Clinton. And they met in a face-to-face meeting in the woods near West Point, where Arnold was the commander. His plan had been to surrender at West Point to the British. He was trying to think of something he could actually do. I mean, they weren't sure what he could do for them. But at any rate, they met, and he gave Andre plans of secret plans of West Point, which Andre put into his boot, in his sock, in his boot. And then Andre had to get back to British lines. and on his way back, he was waylaid by three militiamen who were probably looking for someone to rob. They saw this a young man come by on a horse. He was disguised. He wasn't wearing his British uniform. And they had him take his clothes off. And when he took off his boot, they saw something in his sock, and they pulled out these plans that, that Arnold had given him. And they decided to take him to the nearest militia officer, who looked at the plans and realized that something was wrong. And I should say Andre was sort of carrying a pass from Arnold that was to allow him to pass through the American lines. And this officer was ready to send both Andre and the plans, Andre back to Arnold at West Point, not realizing, or perhaps, I'm never sure what the man's motives were, and the plans off to Washington. When his commander came and realized that that this was probably, Arnold was probably involved in this, in spying, and dashed, had his men dash off and get Andre and bring him back. And they brought Andre under guard to prison, and there he was to be tried. And Washington had him tried by men, a really proper court of officers, and they found Andre guilty of spying. If he had been wearing his uniform, he probably would have been a prisoner of war and been able to be exchanged. But because he was wearing civilian clothing, and these plans were found on him, he was charged with spying. He was very gracious and elegant young man, and won everybody over. All of the people who were trying him thought he was just wonderful. But he had wanted to be executed by a firing squad, which would be a soldier's death, and not hanged, which was the usual death for a spy. And they had a vote on that, and by one vote, the officers who were sitting in that trial decided that he had to be hanged. And so he was. His captors weeping as he went to the scaffold. And he was buried at on the site. But some years later, he was disinterred, and his bones are now in Westminster Abbey in Poets' Corner. So he was much honored afterwards. But I should say, Arnold, when he realized that Andre had been captured, fled. And he fled. He had a little boat of men who rowed him off to a British warship. And he was on that ship, and they went after him once they realized what had happened, once Washington got back to West Point and realized that Arnold was involved in some kind of a plot, but they weren't able to capture him. So he got to New York, which was then in British hands, and he actually did lead a couple of expeditions for the British against the Americans. He wasn't really trusted, and they were very upset. I think that a lot of the British felt that they would have rather had Andre than Arnold. His plot had failed. But at any rate, they sent him on two expeditions, both of which strike me as being the hardest ones for him, the hardest test of his new loyalty. One was to Virginia, and Washington had always been, you know, a great friend of Arnold's and patron. And so he led this group of soldiers into Virginia and actually chased the then governor, Thomas Jefferson, off, and Jefferson fled before this expedition. And the second one was into Connecticut, which was Arnold's
his own hometown. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was extremely hard, I'm sure, to do that. And it didn't end well, because in taking one fort, he had his men burn the ships that were in the harbor, which is what you traditionally did. And this was in the harbor at New London. And there was explosives on one of those ships, gunpowder, and it exploded and started a fire, which burned part of the city of New London. So he was roundly hated there for that. But Washington had a reward on Arnold's head. They desperately wanted to get him. The British were not willing to turn him over, and they never did succeed in capturing him. So he ended up, you know, with a sadly of you know, this life in exile.
Did he live a long life?
He lived to be 60. He lived into the, you know, about till 1801, so the new century.
He outlived Washington, then?
Yes. I forgot when Washington died. Was that
1799, I believe.
99, right. Yeah, he did. It was, he was not honored by the British. I mean, he did get a pension from the king. He had all these children to try and find livelihoods for. Most of his sons went into the army. He wanted to serve in the British Army again while he was living in London, and they wouldn't let him. And he came back and he told his wife, Peggy, they won't let me die a soldier's death. He really wanted to do that. I'd like to say a word about Peggy.
Yeah, the story is that, you know, one of the reasons that he became a traitor was because of Peggy. Is that true or false?
Yeah, well, I should say that Peggy Shippen was the belle of Philadelphia, and her family were very prominent. Her father was a judge, and he wooed her. Her family stayed in Philadelphia when the British had occupied it. They tried to be neutral. And then after the British left, Arnold came in as the commander, the military commander, while the Pennsylvania government returned and other people returned. She has, because she was there during the British occupation, and she actually personally knew Jean André, there's been all this sense that somehow she was involved in this plot. And in 1941, Carl Van Doren wrote a book called The Secret History of the American Revolution. And the main secret he's talking about is that Peggy, who'd always been thought to be innocent of Arnold's plot, was actually involved. She was sort of the Eve tempting him into betraying the cause. And I looked at the evidence, and it was extremely flimsy. He had no direct evidence of that. There was some letter that André had written to Peggy, you know, when André was in New York, saying, can I get you some nice, fine things from New York? And she wrote letters basically saying no. But Van Doren interpreted her letter as just what she would have written if you were in the spy plot. So, but despite the fact that that evidence is so flimsy, there have been something like 7 books recently written just about Peggy Shippen and how evil she was, and apparently there was a television program saying she actually had an affair with Jean André. Poor woman. But looking at what she did, I mean, Arnold wooed her, and she married this man who was a war hero. And then he wanted her to come up to West Point when he became the commander there, and she had this little 6-month-old baby, and she made this long trek up to West Point. And she had only been there 2 weeks before this plot got found out, and Arnold fled. And the day he fled, Washington and his officers, Hamilton and Lafayette, were supposed to have breakfast with the Arnolds at West Point. And she's up feeding her baby, and her husband has just told her he's off to the British, and he leaves. And she becomes hysterical. And Washington and all of his officers speaking with her were convinced that she knew nothing about this plot, that she really was, you know, distraught. And that's how people believed it. And Arnold's own aide said that he never would have confided the plot to her because, you know, she was kind of, you know, volatile and, you know, and emotional, and he didn't trust anybody with it. But what persuaded me that she didn't know was that after he fled, Arnold asked that she be, wrote Washington asking that she be given the choice of either following him into exile in New York or going back to her family in Philadelphia. And she chose to go back to her family. Now, that was a really dangerous thing to do if she truly were involved in that plot. The Pennsylvania executive hated Arnold. They brought all these charges against him. They had a list of some over 300 people that they wanted Arnold to arrest and put on trial for being, you know, pro-British. So the idea that this woman would have chosen to go back to her family if she'd been involved in that plot doesn't make sense to me. She wanted to stay with them, and she even promised the Pennsylvania government that she wouldn't have any contact with him, or if he wrote, she would show them the letters. But after a couple weeks, they decided they just couldn't have her living there. It was too much of a risk. And so she had to go into exile, and she was her father's favorite child, and he accompanied her up to New York and said goodbye, you know, and she spent the rest of her life in exile. She came back once. She was allowed, after the war was all over, to come back to Philadelphia and visit. And it was very sad because all her former friends just shunned her, so she never came back again.
It's a very sad story. It really is, the tragedy of Benedict Arnold and everybody involved. And the book is called The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold, An American Life. And the author, my guest, Joyce Lee Malcolm, thank you so much for talking about the book with us here on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Joyce Lee Malcolm. Her book is called The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold, An American Life. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.